That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. I am Sarah Spain, and I'm super excited for today's guest, Jackie McMullen. When I was living in LA, working at Fox Sports Net, which was the local Fox Sports out there, just my very first sports gig, doing highlights, cutting games, figuring out, you know, logging games and figuring out what the anchor person would say. I didn't have to go into work until later in the afternoon. And so I would watch Around the Horn almost every day, Around the Horn and PTI back to back. And I was really just starting to immerse myself in the idea of being a sports reporter. I had moved to LA to do comedy and acting. And I had a background in sports. I'd been an athlete my whole life. But as you've heard on the pod, it just had never really occurred to me. There weren't enough women in the industry, at least particularly not women that were doing what I had wanted to do, which is bring some kind of comedic sensibility to it. And so I had gotten this job at Fox Sports Net after doing a TV hosting boot camp where I hosted a fake Chicago Bears show. And that's when the teacher said, oh, you want to work in sports? I said, not really. She said, well, maybe try to do it the way you want to do it and give it a shot. So I got this job and I used to sit and watch Around the Horn and PTI almost every day, trying to keep up on the sports news and kind of just figure out what it's like to do it. And I remember watching the likes of Jackie McMullen and Bill Plaschke and Bob Ryan and Woody Page, people that have been on there forever, and just thinking, wow, these people know so much. They're so good at what they do. They're so smart and quick and clever. And when I did my first show and, you know, started working alongside these people, I remember just even talking to Jackie McMullen. I was like, this is a huge deal. And she's become a friend. And when she's in town sometimes for stuff, we get to chat about life and work. And I've been dying to have her on the pod and kind of get to know her background a little bit. And after talking to her, I promise there's going to be a part two because there's too much going on with Jackie Mac and there's too many questions I have for her about her, you know, illustrious career in reporting and some of the barriers that she helped break down. But this is a start. So I hope you enjoy it. This is my conversation with Jackie Mac.
That's what she said.
So let's now welcome in the OG, Jackie McMullen, writer for ESPN.com and the magazine. You can see her regularly on Around the Horn, The Jump, and other ESPN television. Been dying to have you on, Jackie. I'm super excited to chat.
Yeah, how are you today?
Besides getting over my illness, today is the first day I've not taken any drugs, medicine, in like a week and a half. So I feel clear-headed. Which is
very good, because I did not make that today. I did have to take medicine this morning, just so I could be clear for you, my friend.
Well, the good news is, anything you say now cannot be held against you. Every mistake I've made on Twitter, every typo I've been like, I got to stop tweeting with cold meds, just typos everywhere, and then you don't have to own it. So perfect.
Well,
that means you'll be extra loose for the conversation.
Well, and you know me. I don't tweet anyway. My kids
that's
are still dying to pretend to be me to tweet, which just sounds like a... So my son just went to Australia for a study abroad. So do you think he should be tweeting for me? I'm going to say no.
No,
yeah, I'm
going to
say no.
No
to that.
Yeah,
no.
Although it would be vastly more entertaining than you not tweeting at all, it might be dangerous, especially considering the new policies. People are really watching.
Yeah. True.
Let's start at the very beginning. I want to start back in Massachusetts when you're growing up. What kind of kid were you?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, I was a tomboy. So I'm in a neighborhood with, there's not a lot of girls. There's a lot of boys. And they play street hockey every single day. And I just want to play. I just love it so much. And I really want to play. And most of them are pretty good about letting me play. Because I was a good athlete. But there were some older ones that came around. And they were almost high school age. And they're like, yeah, you know, we're not playing with the girl. So my dad, who's a very smart man, bought me a net for Christmas. And if you know anything about street hockey, you know the one thing that you're always dying to have is the net, so you don't have to chase the ball all the way down the street and down the hill. So once I got the net, even the old boys had to let me play.
Nice.
Pretty smart. Fred McMullen
very
is
smart.
A smart man.
Yeah.
Yeah, smart man.
Were you always quite tall?
Yeah, I think so. Skinny, super skinny. Wish that was still true.
Right.
Tall and skinny, big feet. You know,
yeah.
I looked like, all three of us looked the same. And, Yeah, just ran around. I got up in the morning, ran around, played capture the flag or street hockey or, you know, it's funny, everything except for basketball. We just weren't a basketball neighborhood. So I played everything but, you know, what I ended up loving the most.
So did you have siblings?
Yep. I had a younger sister, Susie, who everyone else calls Sue, the poor thing. I'm still calling her Susie, and she's like 55 years old. And an older sister, Karen, who very sadly we lost in 1997. She died of melanoma. Mm. So that's why I always look so pale, because we don't go in the sun.
Right. What did your parents do?
So my dad, interestingly enough, was a paper box salesman.
Right.
Yep, Fred, greatest man ever. Paper box salesman, which sounds like, not that interesting, but he was Bob Kraft's top salesman for Rand Whitney Packaging Corporation.
Okay.
Can't make that up, right?
Yeah.
So
you had an in all along. I knew it. And it must be nepotism.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's funny. When my dad worked for him, he didn't own anything. In fact, we went to a Red Sox game, Mike and I, my husband, who I've been married to for almost 32 years. At the time, we're just dating, and my dad got tickets, you know, the company tickets to go to a Red Sox game. So we go to the game, and we're dressed like bums. It's a Saturday. And doesn't the boss, Robert Kraft, show up? Now, of course, my dad is never dressed like a bum. Mm-hmm. My dad went to all my games dressed in a suit and a tie and a hat.
Wow.
Okay, he doesn't own a pair of jeans. When he does gardening, he wears those, you know, dress pants. I mean, I'm not making this up. He's a gentleman.
Gardening? Oh, my gosh.
Gardening, yeah, anything. He, you know, mowing the lawn, whatever it was. So Mike and I, not so much. So we look a little bit like bums. And in walks Mr. Kraft to this game, and he ends up sitting with us. He was always very nice to me when I was a kid. And he starts talking to Mike and me, and he gestures to the field, to Fenway Park, and says, I'm going to own this team someday.
Hmm.
And I remember saying to Mike, well, I hope I own it too. And I remember going home and asking my dad, I said, so, like, could that happen? He said, oh, do not underestimate Mr. Kraft.
Huh.
And of course, he never got he never got to buy the Red Sox. He was never able to do that. But his quote unquote booby prize.
Yeah,
was the
turned
New
out
England
pretty
Patriots,
well.
The biggest cash cow in sports history, right?
So you played basketball at Westwood High School. Did you do other sports there?
I did. So I didn't play basketball right away, though. I ran track, and I played field hockey, because, again, that's that whole street hockey
my
thing,
three
right?
sports. So, there's so few of us that did those
three. Oh, I know. But everyone back in my day, like, you know, I'm a little older, right? So everyone played three sports back then. And
right,
I
but
did
those
not
specific three. Most
initially.
People do not do field hockey, basketball, and track. There's like one other person I've met that those are their three.
You know what's funny? My daughter, who's only 25, did all three of those in high school.
Nice.
And actually went to college and played a little Division III basketball and could have run track, but I mean, had the good sense not to because it's just too much. But so we kind of believed in that whole well-rounded thing. But I went to try out for the basketball team. So Westwood, home of the champions, it's required to say that. We had an unbeaten league streak that lasted 17 years, I think it was. The coach was Kathy Delaney Smith. She was just an incredible gift to our school, especially if you were a young girl who was looking for a role model. She's now the coach at Harvard and has been the coach at Harvard for 30-some-odd years. And as you know, is the answer to a great trivia question, she's the only number 16 seed in NCAA basketball history to upset a number one seed. And she did that as a coach at Harvard when they upset Stanford. So anyway, she's the coach. The team is amazing. They go to the state tournament every year. So I go to walk in to try out. I look in the door. I don't have any basketball sneakers. And so I chicken out. And I say, well, I'll play next year. I'll go next year. This is my sophomore year. I go back. I go look in the door. They all look tall. They all look better. And I don't try out. I
no
blow
way.
It. I just, yeah,
that
I don't do it.
Strike
I just don't
me
have
as
the
your
courage.
Personality.
Yeah, different. I was different then, you know. I really, I didn't have a lot of courage, honestly. So my junior year, I'm sitting in the, down in the gym, you know, area where all the coaches are. And, I was a gym rat, so I was around a lot. And and she's in a room, and, you know, I was always around her. She was just, there was an aura about her. And even though I didn't play for her, because she was also the swim coach, and I wasn't going to be doing that. And she said, oh, I went down to the middle school today to see the all the basketball players down there, and she turned to me and she said, your sister Susie is really good. And by the way, she was. My sister was terrific. And she said, at least I'll get one McMullen to play for me. So I said, oh, I'll try out this year. And then she looked at me with this horrified look, right? And I said, oh, never mind, that's dumb. It's too late. Yeah, forget it. It's too late. And she looked at me and she said, all this time you wanted to play? I mean, remember now, I'm 5'11". I'm walking around, right?
Yeah.
To school. And she said, she's like, how did I miss it? She said, be here tomorrow morning before school. Yep. So then she started working with me a little bit. So I tried out my junior year. I made the JV because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then she moved me up for the state tournament at the end of my junior year. And then God bless her, actually played me, which was amazing. She threw me into these state tournament games. And then I played my senior year and, you know, then went on from there.
Yeah, that's crazy then. Yeah, for you to not start until so late and still go on to play D1 basketball at UNH.
Well, you can't do that
awesome.
Now. I mean, that would never happen now. It's just,
well, it
it's
only happens
possible.
With someone from, like, Cameroon, right?
Right, exactly, who's 7 feet tall and can block shots
some
into
Nigerian
into
football
Peru.
Player, yeah. Right. So what did you study at UNH?
Well, again, because I'm the OG, there was no journalism major. So here's another stupid thing. I get into Syracuse. I get into the Newhouse School.
Oh, boy.
And I didn't go.
Why not? Like,
I don't, you know, it was kind of far. I was a homebody. And my sister was there. My older sister, Karen, was a nursing major there. And so it felt a little bit like her thing, right? But, you know, secretly, I'm thinking, I'd really like to play basketball in college. Now, I'm getting recruited mostly by Division II schools, you know, not by many Division I schools. I mean, the sample size was pretty small, right? So I'm thinking, I don't think I can play at Syracuse, but, you know, maybe I could play at UNH. And they were pretty good. They were a good team, you know, a strong team for New England. They weren't nationally ranked or anything. Maybe I could play in New England. You know, maybe I could play for UNH. And I loved UNH campus. It was right near the ocean. They had these the college woods. They had all this cross-country skiing. It spoke to me in terms of the landscape of it. It was just a beautiful school. And I looked at all the kids, and I thought, hey, they kind of remind me of me. Like, I think I could do okay here. So my poor father, who, by the way, also went to Syracuse, whenever I told him I was not going to the Newhouse School, I mean, if my kids said that to me, I'd say, yeah, right. You are, or I'm not paying for it, you know, but they didn't do that. They were great. So I went to UNH, and I was an English major, because that's all they had. They didn't have a journalism major.
Same with me. The journalism at Cornell was weird when I was there. They've actually got a great thing going now, but it was in, like, the ag school, and it just wasn't really fleshed out. So
yeah, same with us, UNH. I mean, it's a great program now. And we had a professor there named Don Murray, who looked like Burl Ives, and was a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And I didn't know that when I went there. And he was just a gift. What a gift. I mean, he was so great about encouraging young people and teaching them how to write, but making it seem so fun and so interesting and so exciting. So I was so fortunate to have Don Murray already there and waiting to help me out when I got there.
Yeah, for sure. So when you are there and you're doing, you're playing basketball, you're taking classes, did you already have your mind set on working in sports?
I did. But you know, there weren't a lot of people, right, doing it. So I wasn't exactly sure how it was all going to work. But I liked the idea of it. You know, I tell people I wasn't a walk-on to UNH. I was literally a crawl-on. I wasn't banking on being able to play for 4 years. As it turned out, it worked out okay. But the school paper was great. And I, you know, again, typical, because this was just my personality, Don Murray kept saying to me, you need to go down to the school paper. And I'd be like, yep, I'll do that tomorrow, right after I try out for the basketball team. And he finally said to me, come on, because he was my advisor. And he had to walk me down to the journalism department, I mean, to the school paper, because I was too afraid to walk in there. This is truly who I was.
I'm so confused by this.
I know, everyone is, because I know I'm such a pain in the neck now, huh? But so, you know, when the same thing happened, once I got there, I got into it, I enjoyed it. I was the news editor. And then my last year, I had a chance to be the editor-in-chief. But if I did that, I was going to have to give up the basketball. And I just couldn't do it. And I don't regret that decision at all. Not
well, so
second.
Limited, right? If you're not going to go on and play pro or Olympics or whatever, you kind of take that 4 years and you really
own
it.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't going to be doing any of that. So.
Right. Did it help you to play basketball that you have six toes on one foot?
It does not, although everyone thinks it does. So my best friend, and this is a girl that I've been friends with since I was 15. Her name is Janice McEwen. When we were young, and I'm talking in grade school, they used to have this town-wide field day when we were in the fifth grade, okay? So I did the long jump. I was a good long jumper in high school as well. And I did the long jump, and so did she. And Janice is a lovely person and a godmother to my daughter and like a second mother to my kids, but she's a terrible athlete. Sorry, Janice, if you're listening, which you aren't because you don't know anything about sports, so you would never listen to this. And
I'm going
to
find her.
So, of course, I would beat Janice in the long jump, not by inches, but by feet.
Right.
And she told everybody it's because that's the weird girl with six toes on her foot.
Oh, of course she did.
So, yeah.
Kids are cruel.
I got it through it. I got through
has it done anything? I mean, I'm right now going through terrible physical therapy twice a week. That's just such a hassle, and it's such a drag, but hopefully will work. Does it ever cause any problems to have 6 feet? Well, I tore my Achilles in college track, and so over the length of time, my entire kinetic chain is just totally jacked now. Because these different muscles aren't firing that are supposed to work because they're being held back. So, but have the six toes on one side and not the other ever created an imbalance or any issues?
Yeah. I mean, because it's too, if we're really going to get graphic here, but it's the baby toe, two of them stuck together with a bone through the middle of them. So if you can picture that. So my
Sounds
foot's
hot.
Too wide. My foot's too wide and, you know, shoes hurt and stuff. And I do have a screw in that foot. I had to have a bunionectomy on that foot. I have a screw in my foot. But we got through that. For the most part, I'm pretty lucky. I would argue that it affects my balance, but nobody is giving me that out at all, ever. So when I do fall doing things, whatever it might be, playing tennis or whatever, nobody has any sympathy for me whatsoever.
Well, as a fellow, 6 foot woman, I don't know if we're known for our balance even when we only have 10 toes.
That's why I do yoga. Doesn't yoga help? I do yoga.
It does. It does.
It does.
So you left UNH, and what was the first gig out of school?
Well, so I was very fortunate. I went right to the Globe out of college. And what happened was the UNH had these amazing internships. And one of the things they had was they had one guaranteed spot every year at the Boston Globe on the news side. And so you had to be the sort of like the top kid from UNH that year to get that one spot. Well, because I was playing basketball both semesters, I could never do the in-semester internship. So I was just woefully behind everybody else. So my senior year, I wanted to do that Globe internship, but they don't take college graduates. You had to be an undergraduate because they didn't want people bugging them for jobs. So I'm like, because they said, we'll give it to you, but you got to figure out how to get there. So Andy Merton, another one of my professors who writes great poetry, he said to me, well, let's just defer your graduation. He said, we'll just tell them, nope, we're not going to graduate now. We're going to wait. So that's what we did. So I went to the Globe in the summer of 1982 as someone who had fully completed my college courses, but I was technically still an undergraduate. Now, of course, they figured it out about, 3 weeks into it when my shift was the lobster shift, we used to call it. I worked 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., and I was on the news side, but I used to just hang around the sports department all the time, just making a nuisance of myself. See, now I'm getting a little more assertive as I get older here. And Ian Thompson, who you probably know, worked at the Boston Globe for many years, worked at Sports Illustrated, worked at the National. He was an intern also, and he became my best friend. We're best friends in the business. We have literally grown up in this business together. And he's just a really talented writer. So he started helping me a little bit. And one day I was over there, and something came up and they didn't have any bodies. And I said, I'll do it. And Vince Doria, who, recently retired from ESPN, was like, who the hell is she? And they're like, oh, she's an intern. And he said, all right, go ahead, go do it. So he let me go do it. And so when I got done with my internship, I said to Vince, I said, look, I'm young, I'm cheap, I don't care how much you pay me, I'm a girl. I would do anything to work here. So I had to get another offer. Which I did. I got one from the Orlando Sentinel, which is, where Jemele Hill started out. And I came back from the airport with that offer, and Vince, God bless him, hired me right out of college. It was amazing. I still can't believe it. Yeah, pretty good.
It used to happen more often, it seems.
It can't happen now.
It didn't make it common, but it did make it a little bit more likely back then.
But you know what I think, Sarah? I think now that newspaper staffs are so small that when you get an intern, you send them to everything. Like when I was an intern or when Ian was an intern, they weren't sending him to, you know, Red Sox games or whatever. Right. They were, but now it's just another body. They'll send you to anything, you know, because they need you. They need the body.
That's true.
Changed a lot.
So you were there from 82 to 2008. That's a long time.
Well, in between there, I left. So I was there 82 to 96.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because you went to SI.
And I was pregnant with my son, and then they offered me a job at SI. So Bill Colson said, you know, how about coming to SI? And I said, well, all right, but here's a little secret. I'm pregnant.
Right.
So, but he was great about it. So I went there, and I worked there for 5 years. And then that's during the time my older sister passed away. So I was kind of a little bit in a fog, to be honest with you. I woke up one day and said, you know what? I haven't really processed this, and I want to be home with my kids. So I quit, and I didn't work at all for 2 years.
Hmm.
And it was a really great thing for me to do. I needed to do it for myself, for my kids, for my family, for everything. So I always tell people, you know, if you're good, and if you work hard at what you do, someone will always hire you again. And that someone was the Globe. They rehired me in 2002.
How old were the kids when you left SI?
So let's see. Allie was born in 92. So 2002, she was, 10, I guess? And then Doug is four and a half years behind her. So they were kind of little.
Yeah, 5 and 10-ish.
Right. But they were, you know, by then I was a columnist and just had a pretty good handle on how to do things. And as you know, we work nights, we work weekends. So when you have small children, I was home a lot of days. You know, I'd get them off the bus sometimes 3 days out of five. And so it really wasn't that bad. And the 2 years I took off, that was just such a wonderful gift. Doug was really little then. He was struggling a little bit without me around. And so that's one of the main reasons I quit. I just had 2 years where he was in kindergarten, I think. And I could be around for him. And Allie was one of those kids. She just hit the ground running. You know, she was going to join every academic thing. She was going to join every sports team. You know, she was just a mainstream kid. And Doug was a little different. He was a little more creative, a little different, a little offbeat. It took him a while to kind of find his stride.
Yeah. When you when did you meet your husband?
Oh, I met him at UNH when we were 19, I think.
Wow.
And we were friends for a while. We had a lot of mutual friends. So, you know, we were together almost 7 years before we got married, and now we've been married 32 years on February 7th. So
impressive.
It's amazing. We're still
together.
Every once in a while, we look at each other and say, is this how it's supposed to be? Like, are you supposed to be with the same person your whole life, right?
Right,
because
right.
Literally,
well, did you
we've
take
been
any
together
breaks?
Longer than we've been apart.
Did you take any break? No. So, yeah, that's impressive, too, because a lot of people, they'll meet in college, and then they'll say, well, this feels right, but let's take a break and figure it out. And then they come back and find each other a couple years later. But, yeah, to have been together longer than you were apart is pretty incredible.
It is. And, you know, some days we're like, yeah, this probably wasn't the best idea. And other days we're like, man, thank God we hung in there. So, you know,
right,
just like anybody.
Right, just like anybody,
marriage,
for sure.
I'm lucky. I mean, and you are too. I know already, because if you marry someone in this crazy madcap world that we live in, they have to be incredibly secure in their own selves and their own successes. And what, you know, my husband, I'm an extrovert, obviously. He's an introvert. He would just prefer you didn't really notice him. He'd prefer to stand in the back and watch everything happen. And that's a good thing, because generally that's what happens when we walk into a room, right?
So, right. Yeah.
And he likes sports, but he's not gaga over them. So, you know, meeting Larry Bird to him isn't much different than me meeting one of his good friends at work. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't send him spinning or anything like that. Except for Tom Brady, I would guess. It's funny.
Right.
Tom Brady, men and women alike in New England, he's cast a spell over all of them.
Yeah, it sure seems so. So you're at the Globe until 2008. When did you start doing Around the Horn and writing, at least in part, for ESPN?
Yeah, right about then. So what happened was the Globe was offering buyouts, and this is when they weren't doing badly yet. You know, this is when the buyouts were, you know, they were just, you know, they offer them every once in a while. And we kind of had gotten word that this was probably going to be the last great buyout. Like, if you wanted to do it, this was the one to do. So I remember I was down in spring training. It was April. And people down there were saying to me, oh, who do you think will take the buyout? And I said, oh, I don't know, maybe I should, ha, 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 you know. And then I went back to my, you know, dinky hotel room in wherever we were, Florida. And I remember started thinking, maybe I should do this. Maybe this would be good. And Allie was approaching high school. and then I got this call. So I had done this project with Irvin Johnson and Larry Bird, and it was a picture book. It was supposed to be a coffee table book. And this guy from Canada approached me about doing the text for this beautiful, high-end, you know, $80 coffee table book of Larry and Magic. And I only had to, you know, come up with, I don't know, 20,000 words of prose to go along with this coffee table book. Well, the long and the short of it was the dude from Canada ran off with the money, got bankrupt, and then ended up in he had a mental breakdown, in essence.
Oh, wow.
So the project was kaput. Now you fast forward, and this is years go by now, and I get this call, and it's from Lon Rosen, it's Irvin's agent, and he said, the book is back on, but this is for real now. Let's do a real book this time. And this is what I had been pushing for, because, you know, even for 20,000 words, you start doing your homework. You start asking questions. You start talking to one about the other, and it's amazing how much they had pent up about one another because they were mortal enemies. They were rivals, you know. So anyway, that's how when the game with ours came about. So I came back from spring training. I said to Joe Sullivan, the sports editor of the Globe, I really want to do this book. And he said, I can't give you any time off to do it. You know, I don't know how you're going to do this and do your job and whatever. And so that just clinched it for me. I thought, you know what? I'm going to take the buyout. I'm going to do this book. And I'll see what happens next. And so by the time I took the buyout, it was, I guess, yeah, late April. And the Celtics, it's 2008 now. The Celtics are really good. And there's a chance they can go all the way. So I remember saying to the Globe, hey, look, I'm going to take the buyout, but I don't want to hold you in the lurch here. I'll stay on through the playoffs. I'll write for you guys. I'll do everything I can for you, and then I'll be on my way. And they were really mad I took the buyout. Really mad. And they said, get your stuff and get out. Almost 20 years. So I was mad. I said, all right, I'll be happy to do that. And I called up ESPN. I called up Vince Doria, who had been my Globe editor for many years and was now at ESPN. And I said, you want me to freelance for you through the playoffs with the Celtics? He said, what's going on? I said, I want to bury him. I mean, I was mad. Ooh. I was really mad. And so that's what I did. I did cover those playoffs, but I covered them for ESPN and did my level best to bury them because I can be that way sometimes.
Did you
and
feel
now
like
we're
the,
all fine.
The burying
it's all fine
occurred?
With the Globe now. Yeah, do it all worked
like,
out.
Do you feel like the burying occurred, though?
Yeah, I don't know. I think so. It just,
that's a yes.
You know, it just at the time they were mad that I was leaving. I was mad that, you know, they didn't, I don't know. We both probably could have handled it a little better. But it's all fine now. I mean, I love Joe Sullivan. I consider him a good friend, and all those guys at the Globe are still, you know, I had lunch today right before I did this podcast with Ian Thompson, Lee Montville, and Don Squire, all former Globe luminaries. We probably have close to 300 years experience at that table. And, you know, they're my lifelong friends. I mean, they'll never, ever, for me, be a better experience than being 21 years old and working at the Boston Globe with Montville, Bob Ryan, Shaughnessy, the great Will McDonough. I mean, you just
yeah,
can't.
Yeah, just learning. Yeah.
Yeah, just can't beat that. So
really quick, do you remember the time period, maybe not a moment, but the time period when you went from somebody who needed other people to help you assert yourself to being able to you know,
do
walk
myself
into places and want to torch your enemies and such?
Right. Well, I mean, you had to, the job required a real thick skin and a real independent streak and an ability to stand up for yourself right away. I mean, I'm 21 years old. It's 1982, okay? Mm-hmm. So the credential says Jackie McMullen from the Globe. I show up and they're all like, "Who the hell are you?"
Because oh, right, they're expecting
I always say that
a
the
male
best thing
Jackie
that ever happened. Yeah, the best thing that ever happened to me when I first started out in Boston, which can be a very tough, discriminating town, was nobody knew I was a girl. They thought I was a guy. So it became, oh, this guy really knows his stuff, or, oh, this guy sucks. But either way, I wasn't Nancy McMullen. You know, they couldn't already make up their mind that they weren't going to give me a shot. And I really think it made all the difference in the world for me to try to establish myself in this market. I had three people that validated me fairly early on, and I don't know why. Two of them are gone. One was Will McDonough, who just was so great to me. And I don't know why. He just was. He was so great to me. The other one was Larry Bird, who's still here, and just decided, all right, she knows what she's doing. And the third guy was Red Auerbach. And if you had those three guys in Boston saying, yes, she's okay, you had a real shot.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
did you feel welcome when you arrived in places and they saw that you were a woman, maybe as you were,
you were
earning those guys'
trust? No,
not
early on. It was very difficult very early on. You know, especially because I was covering mostly colleges. And the pro leagues, they all had very set rules. You know, it was equal access. That's just the way it was. There was no, you know, David Stern was going to settle for anything less. Same thing in the NHL. They were just happy to see you, right? So the most difficult places to go, for sure, were into the locker room in Foxborough. And Fenway Park was a nightmare for someone like me, a young person who's starting out. And it's funny, one of the guys that gave me kind of a hard time was Bruce Hurst, pitcher, great pitcher for the Red Sox. We're talking, you know, early, mid-80s. He would have been the MVP of the World Series had they won in 86 and not blown it to the Mets. And he was a Mormon, a very devout Mormon, and every time I came into that clubhouse, he would shake his head, make a lot of noise. You know, he made it difficult for me. Now, in later years, I have great respect for Bruce. We've ended up to be quite friendly. I understand exactly where he was coming from. You know, I don't think anybody wanted me in there. I didn't want to be in there, but it was my job. It's really that simple. So I had to do my job, and that's all I had to. That's all I was doing in there, and that's all I wanted to do while I was in there. And I made that as clear, and, you know, I tried to be as professional as possible. I always say that I feel like when I was younger, I was at quite a disadvantage because when I started covering teams, like when I started getting involved with covering the Celtics, for instance, you know, a lot of the guys, if they were trying to develop relationships with players or coaches or GMs, they'd say, hey, meet me in the hotel bar. Let's go have a beer and we can talk about this. Well, you know, I just never felt like I could do that. Now, I probably could have, but I just chose not to. I just wanted to be above reproach. So, you know, it took me a little longer sometimes to develop relationships. Professional relationships I'm talking about, you know, so where players would trust you and know that you had their, you know, that you could keep a secret if you needed to, or that you knew what you were talking about. So that took a little time.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in a little bit about, you know, establishing relationships with players and stuff and your books. But just to stick with the timeline, so since 2008, it's been sort of freelance with ESPN and then eventually a full time, but that's been the focus, you know, pretty much for the last 10 plus years or so.
It really has. ESPN has been great to me, and they, you know, they started those regional, remember the ESPN Boston? I think you started the ESPN Chicago, did you not?
I did,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. And so that was the perfect thing for me, Sarah, because by that point, Doug's in high school. Allie's in college. Is she in high school? I can't remember. I guess she's in high school, too. And Doug, so that would make Doug in middle school. But Allie's playing sports. I want to go to all the games. And then she goes on to college, and I still want to go to all the games. And I want to go to all Doug's stuff. Doug was involved in, you know, he was playing a little basketball at the high school, and I don't want to miss any of that stuff. And so when they hired me for ESPN Boston, I said, look, here's my daughter's schedule, and so I'm not available these days. If you guys are good with that, we got a deal. And I'll travel, you know, for the playoffs and things like that, but I don't need to go anywhere. And so that was kind of the arrangement, and I was able to enjoy my kids' endeavors all the way through and be part of that and still, you know, get to write a lot of cool stories. Of course, the Patriots won a few Super Bowls. The Celtics won. No, they won after. No, they haven't won since. But the Bruins, I got to be in Vancouver when the Bruins won the Stanley Cup, which for me as a lifelong hockey fan, especially as a kid growing up in Boston, that was amazing to be there just to see it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Red Sox.
Did you get to be there when they lost to the Blackhawks?
I was there. In fact, they lost at home. And I was about to press hit on my flight.
I bet. Yeah,
and,
I bet.
Nope. Don't need it. Don't need it. Oh, yeah, I was there for
that. That was a crazy one.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. You're a Blackhawks fan, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you're like me in that you've kind of, you know, you do national stuff, of course, but you are really rooted in the Boston sports scene, and that's a bonus to you. That's a plus. Was there ever any attempts to get you to move to Bristol or elsewhere and to focus otherwise?
Yeah, I missed. There were a couple occasions, a couple of jobs, which I'm not going to really I don't ever like to bring them up because whoever got the job after, I don't
right.
want to make
you don't
it
want
sound
them
like,
to know. Right.
Yeah, I don't really think that's cool to do. But I had a few opportunities. But we were settled here, my husband and I. My husband has a very good job, and, you know, he really wasn't looking to move. At one point, he was working with New York Life, and we did both have a chance to go to New York. But that just wasn't something that either one of us found particularly appealing. Now, while I was at the Globe all those years, I used to do this thing called the NBA Beat. Oh, my God, if you want a laugh and a half, look those up. I had no television experience whatsoever. I was awful, awful. And for several of them, extremely pregnant and fat. So have some fun at my expense if you want to look those up. But what happened was they were preparing, as you know ESPN does, to get NBA rights. So they were preparing all the way back in the 90s for when they were going to have the rights to NBA games. And it got to the point where they were going to do that, and they offered me a full-time job at ESPN, and I was going to have to move to Bristol, and I was going to be an NBA on-air and, you know, written reporter for ESPN. And I thought about it, but we just didn't want to move to Bristol. Our kids were born by then. We were settled in this town, and it would have been interesting to see where that would have led me, but I don't know. I've never made any professional decision that I've regretted because usually I was thinking about our personal life. And, you know, maybe I didn't make quite as much money as I could have. Maybe I'm not as visible as I might have been. Really, really happy with the decisions I made. And sometimes some were a little harder than others. But I never looked back and said, I should have done that one. I never have felt that way.
Yeah, I think a couple of years ago is when I was like, okay, from here on out, like every decision I make has to be because it will make me happier, not because it will make me more money or more noteworthy or more famous.
Well, you're smart because some people never come to that realization.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem worth it. Yeah, yeah. Then you never know because there's obviously opportunities that you might have taken that would make you happier. You just aren't letting yourself open up to that. But taking my chances
But, you know, one thing hasn't changed much about me. I'm pretty much a homebody. Do you realize I have worked for the Boston Globe, ESPN, and Sports Illustrated and lived in the same house for all three jobs? How many people can say that?
Homebody for sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. So what we were talking about, finding and keeping sources and, you know, you wrote a book with Larry Bird, you wrote a book with Gino Auriemma, you wrote the bestseller with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and then another with Shaquille O'Neal. These players not only have to trust you and like your work, but also feel like you're going to be the one to tell their story the best. How does that happen?
Well, each one of them was a little different, you know, so Larry, I covered for many years. Never had any idea, Sarah, what he thought of me one way or another, truly. I mean, I used to think, yeah, I think he kind of likes me because he would tell me things. You know, he would talk to me, but I never really knew. I didn't have a tight relationship the way, say, Bob Ryan did. You know, Bob Ryan had a great relationship with him. And I just really didn't know what my relationship was. But when I was at Sports Illustrated, Larry was coming back as the Indiana Pacers coach. So I called Gillian, his longtime agent, and said, hey, SI would like me to do this story, you know, because Larry was always tough to get access with, and certainly Larry knew who I was. So he said, yeah, come on out. So I went out, and I did this story with him, and, you know, we hadn't seen each other in a while. It had been a while, and I'd grown up a lot, I think. A lot had happened to me. You know, I'd gotten married, had kids, the death of my sister, a lot of things. And I don't know, we just kind of connected in a way. Maybe I was a little less starstruck. I don't really know exactly. But I just remember the interview was great. They ended up putting it on the cover. And we just kind of, I felt like, that was really, I really enjoyed Larry. You know, I felt a little more at ease. I felt a little more on the same plane, maybe even. So, I don't know, a year later, perhaps, I got a call from Jill. And she said, hey, this is confidential. Larry's going to be doing a book. I said, that's great. And I'm thinking she's going to run some authors by me. And she said, do you want to write it? And I said, well, let me think about it. Yes. So that's how that one came about. The book did well, but of course Larry didn't promote it, wouldn't go on a single show, you know, which I knew that ahead of time. But I had never written a book before, so it was an amazing experience for me to do this book with Larry. And he was incredibly, incredibly candid in that book. I think had it been marketed differently, had he been willing to go out there and promote it, which he was never willing to do, it probably would have done a lot better because there's some pretty amazing stuff in there, actually, that he says. But because of that success, what happens is then the next book, which was Geno, the publishing house contacted me and said, we want you to do this book. Now, I barely knew Geno. I certainly knew of him. I knew his story. I had covered his teens a few times, but I did not have a relationship with him at all. And so they said, why don't you just talk to him? So I talked to him one night for an hour on the phone, and I thought, wow, this guy's pretty interesting. So I think I was probably forced on Geno, or maybe Geno said, hey, how about Jackie McMullen? I don't really know. I've never asked him. But that was a different one. And then, of course, when The Game Was Ours, I've explained the backdrop to that. And then Shaq, he was playing for the Celtics. He was living in Lincoln Sudbury, which is 25 minutes from where I live. And he was doing all this crazy stuff. Remember, he was the statue at Harvard Square. He was hiding tickets places. He was doing Shaq-like things.
And well, that was like the start of Twitter, too. That's how he really got everybody interested, because you had to be on Twitter to know.
Yeah, and I knew Shaq well. I had covered him for many years. And so one day he was doing one of his crazy things, and I said to him, you should write a book. He said, well, I've already written two. I said, yeah, it's time to write another one. I said, come on, let's do a book. And he said, okay. That's how Shaq is, you know?
Yeah, so, just that easy.
A few days later.
Man, I'm going to try that. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, he called me up. There's guys call me up, and I'm like, look, it'll be easy. He's right here. Well, you know, I'll just come over. You know, it was a 25-minute commute. And so we were going to have a year and a half or 2 years to do the book. We were going to, you know, have it come out when he retired, and we were going to take our time and do all this stuff. And then he wrecked his Achilles. Remember, he had that terrible Achilles injury. And then it became very apparent to all of us his career was over.
Yeah.
And so we went from having a year and a half to do this book to having like 5 months to do it. So we had to just crank it. We had to crank it, which we did. But Shaq was a lot of fun to work with. He's a complicated guy. He's hilariously funny. He's one of the most entertaining people I've ever been around in my life. He can be very, very tough, but he is also one of the most generous. He might be the most generous athlete I've ever seen, because he's the kind of guy where you're sitting in his kitchen, you know, you're about to do your interview, and you're eating breakfast made by his wonderful chef, and he sees this sad story on TV, and he tells his assistant, write down the name of that, find out what's going on with that kid, and writes out a check for $1 million at his kitchen table.
Wow.
That's the kind of guy Shaq is, and I don't know too many of them that do that.
And it's not publicized that much.
No, it isn't. It isn't. He's just a really, really generous guy. There was this kid, it was so sad, when I was doing the book with him, who had this disease, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it, but he couldn't stop growing. And, you know, eventually it was going to have a very tragic end to it. But in the meantime, this poor kid, this teenager, he couldn't find any clothes to fit him. So Shaq would, you know, saw this on television and started packing up all his clothes and sending them to this kid. And then, of course, the next thing you know, the kid's coming down and swimming in Shaq's pool. And he's got a big heart that way.
Yeah, that's great. And that's, I guess, the kind of stuff that you'd love to discover about someone as you're working on a book, as opposed to the opposite.
Find out some other stuff that you could do without.
Right. That leads me to my next question, which, you know, we're going to have a part two, because this always happens to me, particularly, I think, with folks who are investigative reporters and who do a lot of feature stories, because I'm fascinated by it. It's not something I do. And I'm interested in how you guys, you know, get people to trust you. And I wonder, you know, how often when you're getting something juicy, do you feel like you're tricking someone into giving you that info that'll sort of raise eyebrows? And how often do you think they know what they're saying and what it's going to create, and they're saying it anyway?
Well, that's a really good question. And sometimes people know, and I always felt it was my job to sort of say, now, you know, I'm on the record right now with you, right?
Right.
Like I did a story with Paul Pierce. It had to be, I guess, 3 seasons ago now. He was playing with Washington, remember? Had a great year with Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He was down there. And I hadn't seen him for a while. He had left, you know, he'd been in New Jersey the year before, and he was with Washington. And I said, hey, I miss seeing you around. He said, come on down. So I came down. And he just blew up everybody. You know, Deron Williams, the Nets.
Mm-hmm.
He blew up Ray Allen. He was just like throwing, he even just bombs. And I said, Paul, you know I'm recording all this, right?
I'm going to write this down.
You know, occasionally you feel obligated to do that. And, you know, I just did a Kyrie Irving piece. And I don't know Kyrie super well, but I wanted to get that story. He hadn't really talked to anybody, and I wanted to be the one that he ended up talking to. I started doing the story. And he said, I'm not doing any sit downs. I just don't want to do it. I said, okay. But I kept doing my reporting. And then I went to him and I said, hey, I got to do this story with you or without you. Mm-hmm. I would prefer to do it with you. And so I started, by then I knew which question, you know, I knew some things. So I knew which questions right. to ask. I had an idea of what might be going on in his head. And so he said a lot of stuff. And then at one point he did say, there were some things he said that you will not read in that piece. And he went back and he said, you know what? I don't want that in there. Can we not put that in there? And he had just sent it to me 3 yeah. minutes earlier. And I always honor that. Right. I always honor that because I think of all the things I've said and wish I could stuff them back in my mouth. So I think when you honor that, that builds trust for some of the wonderful things you can get him to say and that he's willing to say. But I've had stories. I had one story. I won't say who it was, a long time ago, an NBA player. It was an explosive story. I got home. I'm like, oh, my God, this is going to be crazy. He called me that night. He said, I don't want to do it. Please, I don't want to do this. I'm asking you. And I didn't do it. And I probably should have.
That hurts, but, though, when you get the good stuff. Yeah.
I probably should have done it, but I just felt, and I think going forward, I'm sure he'd share that story with others. That's what kind of happens. You know, one of the stories I did.
Right, like once
ago,
they do it once, they say, well, maybe it wasn't so bad, and then it dulls it, and then eventually someone else gets to report it.
Yeah, that's it. And sometimes it's you, 2 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
That's happened to me before, too. Teddy Bruschi once, I did a story with him, and the premise was, here's this amazing linebacker, this overachieving linebacker, who is absolutely crazed looking when he's on the field and so calm and reserved off the field. How do you reconcile these two different personalities? That was my premise going in. Mm-hmm. I went to his home. He was nice enough to invite me to his home. His wife was there. I remember his newborn baby. He had him in his palm. That's how little the baby was. I could still see them. And I said to him, how do you, you know, you're so calm and measured off the field. How are you this crazy man on the field? And he kept looking at his wife, and he really didn't answer me. And I'm like, what is going on? So, you know, we talked a little more, and I kind of did an end around back around to that. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, it turned out that Teddy Bruschi had a problem with alcohol. So the guy that I saw in that present time was that measured man, but years earlier, as recently as 2 years earlier, was a freaking maniac, was going out after games with his teammates, driving home, you know, impaired, you know, lots of things like that. And so he kind of had to make up his mind, was he going to share that with me? And he ended up deciding to share it with me. His wife was there, and it was a pretty emotional moment, a pretty emotional story. I got home that night. I went to practice the next day. I saw him. He pulled me aside. He said, I don't think so. I don't think I can do this. And I said, look, I just think you're going to change a lot of people's lives here. You got to trust me. And he did. And he let me run it, and it had a really good effect because there's a lot of people out there struggling with alcohol and struggling with the same kind of things that he was. And so I think because of the way that ended up, that's why later on when he had the stroke, the first reporter he talked to was me. And I think that's why.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes it goes the other way. Sometimes you write stuff and people are like, I'll never talk to you again. And guess what? They mean it. They don't.
Yeah.
They mean
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that happens, too.
All right, speed round. Who's your favorite athlete to interview?
Oh, gosh, that's so hard. off the top of my head, I guess it was Charles Barkley. I had the occasion, Barkley blew out his Achilles. I happened to be in Philly when he did it, and he was coming up to Boston next. He was playing with Houston, and we sat in the Ritz, and he gave me one of just the greatest interviews ever. It was so fun to just sit there and cry and laugh with him because he's got so many stories.
He's a really good dude. He says the wrong thing sometimes, but yeah. I was working the ESPYs 2 summers ago, and I remember he walked up to me on the red carpet. He said, "Hey, Sarah," and I was like, "Wow, he remembers my name." And he said, "Congrats on the wedding," and I was like, "And he remembers? I just got like just stuff like that that you just don't expect." And I don't really work with him, you know. Just the fact that he knew
he's not perfect, but he never said he was right.
Right, and people like him because he's genuine and transparent, and that's a lot harder.
Incredibly
to find these days
so. And that day in the Ritz, I'll never forget that as long as I live. I was working for SI at the time, and I called him up. I go, "Guess what I got?" I mean, but it was just so. Aside from the story itself, just to sit there with him and listen to him reminisce and go through his career was really, it was great.
Shoot the bleep, yeah.
Yeah,
your favorite coach to interview?
Oh, God, these are hard. My favorite coach to interview. I used to love to interview George Karl. because he would just give it to you right back. I thought I thought he was so sassy, and I know he's not, you know, the most popular guy right now because he's unearthed some of the bodies and all that, but he was
a
fun guy to just sort of spar with, back and forth with. I enjoyed the exercise with him.
Who is one of your least favorite athletes to interview?
Josh Beckett. That's easy.
Really?
I don't like the way Josh Beckett handled other people. Not so much me. He never really did anything to me personally, but he liked to demean people. He liked to make people feel small. He liked to get the PR people in trouble by swearing when they weren't, when they didn't have the delay on yet, you know, things like that. I don't dig people like that.
Trying to make other people's jobs. I don't have a problem with athletes maybe thinking that they're bigger and more important than they should, but I do dislike it though when they don't respect that other people have jobs, and not all of us were born to be pro athletes.
So quote unquote, like little people that don't have job security or don't have you know, the big salaries or the platform to call people out, that I really don't like that.
Yeah, agreed. Least favorite coach to interview?
See, people would think I would say Bill Belichick, but that's not true because I think he's hilarious. Because you can't take anything he does seriously.
Right.
God, it was pretty much every baseball manager when I was in my 20s, if I could be general. The only
baseball,
one that was kind of nice to me was Joe Torre. The rest of them were, you know, just didn't want anything to do with me.
Yeah. Who's your dream subject for a feature story?
In the future, going forward?
Yeah.
Former President Barack Obama.
Oh, that would be a really good one, huh?
Yeah. It's not going to happen, but we can dream.
You never know.
Dream,
you never know. You never know. And is there something else on your work bucket list?
Well, you know what? There is, but I'm not going to get to it. It's not going to happen. But I never covered Wimbledon. Now, I've been to Wimbledon, and I covered Olympic tennis at Wimbledon during the 2012 Olympics, but I never covered a match at Wimbledon. And I think that's something that I'm sorry I didn't get to do. And I don't see it in my future.
Why not?
Well, we'll see. But the question is, Sarah, who do we even bring it up with? Who's our boss to ask?
Right. I guess we'll find out soon.
Right, let's hope.
Start planting some seeds.
Let's root for Tony Reale. I bet he'll let me go.
Oh, he'll send you for sure. Yeah, we're in a good spot if Tony becomes president.
Wouldn't that be awesome? It would be. It'd be so great.
All right, well, before I get to the final question, I wanted to quick ask you about your work in Africa and if you have another trip coming up, because I want to hear more about that someday.
Yeah, I would like to go again, so... What you're referring to is this great group I'm involved in called Shooting Touch, and we use basketball as a platform in Rwanda to try to improve the quality of life for young people and now women and the moms too. So we build basketball courts adjacent to health centers, and if you join our program in Rwanda, you get free health care, which is $6 a year over there, and, you know, 80% of the families can't afford it. So we try to get these kids into the program, learn how to take care of themselves. We get their shots, their immunizations. We teach the young girls and the young women about being strong and independent and having a voice and being able. One of the big things we did was a sex education thing where we taught them it's all right for you to say no. You're allowed to say no. If some boy says, I want you to come in here and I'm going to take advantage of you, you have the right to say no. So I was over there last March and I saw firsthand some of the work we're doing and it just blew me away. Rwanda is a beautiful, damaged country that still has some tension simmering just below the level. Of course, that's what happens when you have a genocide. I mean, I just, you know, they're trying to hit the reset button and ask everybody to go along as if nothing happened. And I think that's very difficult for the people who live there. I'm hoping to go back maybe next fall. I was thinking about going again this March, but my son is studying abroad in Australia. So we're off. We're off to Australia, mate. We're going to go.
That was part of my honeymoon and it was wonderful. So.
Oh, you went there on your honeymoon?
Australia and New Zealand. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So once this podcast is over, you're going to tell me all the great places
all
I need to go then, hopefully, right?
Yeah, and one of my best friends is from there, and he's back there right now, just got engaged while he was back there. So he's got really all the good tips because he's lived there.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so Doug's at Gold Coast. He's at Bond University in Gold Coast, which is just north of Brisbane. So we got a lot of exploring to do.
Yeah, and well, I think I'm going to be back in Africa next year too. We were going to go this fall, but now it's going to be next year because I've got a cousin's wedding in Hawaii instead. So you go with your mom again?
Did you go with your mom?
Well, my mom has never been, so that's why we're going. My husband and I went. That's where we got engaged a couple years ago.
Oh, okay.
But my mom has never been, so if you'd like to be hooked up with Shooting Touch and see the work we're doing in Rwanda,
I can make that happen with a snap of a finger.
Well, we have lots to talk about after the pod is over then. But before the pod ends, you have to do the one thing that everybody does, and nobody expects it. It's the Spanish Inquisition.
Huh.
Number one, what's the natural talent you'd like to be gifted with?
Oh, I wish I could sing for real instead of the crap that comes out of my mouth.
It's everyone's answer. Almost everyone.
Yeah.
Number two, your desert island album. You can only have one.
Oh, that's easy because it's only one. I've played this game before. Four-Way Street, it's a double album. It's Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young live.
There you go. Nice workaround. Three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Well, I think after the other night, I'm going to say Oprah Winfrey.
There you go. That was a pretty decent night for her.
Yeah, you think?
Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, recently, on my way to do the jump with my pal Rachel Nichols, I take an Uber from Lax to downtown, and the Uber driver's new, and he gets a flat tire, and we are broken down in the middle of the L.A. freeway.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm talking the middle of the L.A.
Like
freeway.
Like 405, like six lanes?
You got it. And I'm like, I'm going to die. This is how I'm going to die. I always thought I was going to die some really cool way. I'm going to die on a freaking freeway
in
California.
You. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, that's terrible. Then you just had to sit and wait for AAA or something?
You know what? Another Uber came. I'm not even kidding you. And the driver, the first Uber driver is getting out of the car. I go, do not get out of the car.
Yeah.
The other Uber pulled up, and I literally, you know, the cars were like 2 inches apart, and I jumped in to the other car.
Oh, my
and,
gosh.
And off I went.
Oh, that's a good one. Number five, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Oh, my biggest failure. Well, I think I've let some people down. There was one story in particular I did, and it was a guy named Dan Allen. He was a football coach who may or may not have had ALS. His family was convinced he was poisoned by some toxic chemicals put on a court. He was the football coach at Holy Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew Dan from when he was an assistant at Holy Cross and a player at Holy Cross. And he was nice enough to let me tell his story. And I thought I told it in a wonderful, touching way that would make his family feel good about it. And the exact opposite happened.
Oh.
And I carry that one around. He did pass away. And his family was so upset with how the story came out, and I was really shocked by that. I thought I had hit the right notes for them, and I didn't, and I feel like I really let them down and caused them pain and suffering at a time where they had too much of that going on already.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. That's really
hard. Yeah, really. I've always prided myself on sort of knowing what was right.
What notes
and,
to hit,
I think, you know, I asked the people around the story afterwards, I'm like, why did they hate this so much? Because everyone else, you know, had the reaction I expected. And one of the people kind of close to Dan Allen said, because it's too real, like you just spelled out for them what their life, you know, and I hadn't thought of that. So,
yeah.
So
really
I let
hard.
That family down and I'm truly sorry about it.
Yeah. Part two, we're going to talk about that too. Cause that's something I talked to Ramona about, how hard it is to be the person who breaks or tells stories that aren't going to do good things for people. That's really hard.
Right.
I don't think I could do that. That's
no, you can do it. I mean, this case, that was because they didn't, it wasn't a breaking news story. It wasn't, you know, they didn't ask me to do it. I asked them to do it. But like when you break news and someone does something wrong or is getting traded, that to me, that's just part of the business. That's a little different. I mean, I've had to do a lot of unpleasant stories. The most unpleasant one by far was to be involved in an investigative series on Reggie Lewis and his cocaine use. I mean, that was no fun.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie Lewis, I covered from, you know, we literally grew up together in the business. He was playing at Northeastern. I was covering Northeastern. And Jim Calhoun was the coach back then. And then he graduated to the pros the same time I graduated to the pros. I mean, there wasn't a player that I knew better or cared about more. And yet, you know, that story was important because, you know, they sued a doctor And there was a lot that went on there. And the truth, you know, we needed to uncover the truth. And we needed to work on that story. And it wasn't fun at all. We got all sorts of awards for it, which I don't even know where they are because I took no joy in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
But that happens sometimes.
Better question, number six. What habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Well, they tell me I'm easy to talk to. People tell me stuff. So
yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing. People feel comfortable telling me things, I guess because they think I'm going to present it in the way that they feel comfortable with. I guess that's probably the thing that's worked out the best for me.
Right, and a lot of people know if their story is going to be told anyway, then they might as well be in on it and tell
right.
it to someone that
you
they
bet.
Trust. Which, yeah. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Oh, I wish I didn't swear so much. I hate that I do. Yeah, that's like number one, because I did it today, and I was like going out to the car, and I slipped, and I went, ah, but you know, bleep, diddy, bleep, and I looked,
yeah.
and this woman was walking by, and I'm like, ah,
oh.
that's unfortunate. Yeah, I hate that about myself.
I feel that way when I swear in front of my mom.
I like to blame our business, but that's probably not fair.
Yeah, I can't blame the business because I do radio every day. So if anyone should stop swearing, it should be me just to make it easier not to do it on the air. But
right.
I don't
but
feel
don't
bad usually
because
usually it's for emphasis. No, no,
right.
no. I accidentally said the S word once because I was trying to say bat bleep crazy and instead I said bat bleep insane. So I changed the wrong word.
Oh, okay. That's funny.
I was editing, but I changed the wrong one. Yeah.
I mean, I don't really think I've ever sworn on live television or anything like that. Which is why I should be able to do it in my own home, right?
Yeah, horrible. Yeah. Well, that's what I think. If I stopped, it would make sure it was less likely to happen on the air if I did it less in general. But sometimes
right.
you really need a good, well-placed F-bomb. It's important.
Yeah, it's terrible. I hate myself.
And finally,
for it. I have kids, and they're like they swear, and it's my fault. It's totally my fault.
Yeah, it is. It probably
yep.
is.
You know, it is. No doubt.
Number
no doubt.
Eight. Well, at their age, though, it can, at this point, it's not necessarily your fault. When they're young, it's definitely your fault.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like my kids were going around saying, bleep you, lady, when they wouldn't give her a piece of cheese or anything. But
right. Well, I mean, I have a friend who has a seven-year-old who really does drop F-bombs and thinks it's funny. And I'm like, well, that's entirely your fault. And he's like,
yeah,
isn't
no,
it?
No, we didn't have that 100%. Going on. I'm talking as they
yeah.
got older. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
The things we carry around.
Finally, number eight. What three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Oh, wow. Well, fair always comes to mind. Kind.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I don't know. Yeah,
fair,
I guess those
kind,
three.
And interesting.
I don't know
those
if any
good.
Of those are true, but
those are good.
That's what I would hope.
I find you.
We can always hope, Sarah.
So
we
let's
can always
start.
Hope.
That's right. That's right. Awesome to talk to you, Jackie. And like I said, I'm sure there will be a part two. I want to dive deeper into all your stories and features in life and everything, but I really appreciate you coming on.
All right. And now we got to figure out when we're going to have our off-the-air conversation. We can swear all we
yes.
want, talk about Africa. And,
that's true. And Australia.
And Australia. Sounds good. Sounds like a date.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
This week's That's What She Read is a story that's been going viral, and you might have seen it on some sort of random website that tries to get clicks and repurposes it. But it's worth reading in whatever iteration you happen to see it in. It's about an Australian woman named Holly Butcher, who's 27 years old. She died from Ewing sarcoma. And she left behind a letter, and she asked her family to post it on Facebook after her death. And a lot of the letter is a lot of the things that you read someone writing about when they have to face their mortality at a very young age, carpe diem, and enjoying life to the fullest and all of that stuff. But it's a particularly intriguing one because of its frankness. And there was one line in it that I wanted to read to you because it's something I have resolutions sort of written down, but one of my resolutions last year was to try not to engage as much on social media with people who are just trying to get my goat. Because even though sometimes I like to torch trolls and sometimes I like to engage them and see if I can talk them out of whatever it is that they're angry at me about with me about, sometimes I have to tell myself that if this person was looking me in the eye in person and saying the things they were, I would walk away from them. First of all, they wouldn't say those things in person. But if they were, I wouldn't give them my time and my attention. And so that's been one of my goals. And there was a line in this that she wrote, and it really just stood out to me. You can find it. There's one version on people.com. And the headline is just letter penned by Australian woman, 27 on her deathbed goes viral. Be grateful for each day. That's one of the headlines if you want to find it. But the part that stood out for me is when she said, I tried to live a healthy life. In fact, that was probably my major passion. Appreciate your good health and functioning body, even if it isn't your ideal size. Look after it and embrace how amazing it is. Move it and nourish it with fresh food. Don't obsess over it. While on this topic, delete any account that pops up on your news feeds that gives you any sense of feeling crap about yourself. Friend or not, be ruthless for your own well-being. All right, so none of that is anything super novel, right? Be healthy, appreciate yourself, don't obsess about your weight or your size, and, you know, surround yourself with positivity. But that specific way of writing it just really struck me. Be ruthless for your own well-being. And a lot of people talk about how protective we are of our friends and our family and the people that we love, how much we take care of them, and we don't do the same for ourselves, and how ruthless we would be in protecting the ones we love, but maybe not so in protecting ourselves. So I decided that that is a new mantra. Be ruthless for your own well-being. And I'm going to put it into place in social media and elsewhere. But I've done a pretty good job, we've talked about on the pod, of removing most a-holes from my life, my everyday life. I don't interact with a-holes, but on social media I do. So that is going to be cut down. Goodbye, trolls. More mutes and blocks in the new year. I'm going to be more ruthless for my own well-being. And I hope you will be too. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
Well, that's what she said.